Today, as we continue our sermon series on the theological virtues, particularly the third virtue now of love, we turn to what are sometimes called the Great Commandments in Matthew chapter 22, verses 34 through 40. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which commandment of the law is the greatest?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." This past week, the neighbor across from us cut down a beautiful, healthy, perfectly straight, 40 or 50 foot tall Douglas fir tree in his yard. I watched as he and his son climbed the tree, hacked off the green branches, and lowered them to the ground. As I write and record this sermon, the ugly bare trunk of the butchered tree stands there waiting to be brought down itself in the final act of destruction. As you might guess from my description of this event, I'm struggling to find some love for my neighbor at this moment. I totally understand the removal of leaning, dead, problem trees in our neighborhood. We've done it ourselves. But taking out healthy specimens just to get rid of the nuisance of falling needles and occasional falling branches just seems wrong. As Beth said, why live in this neighborhood if you don't like trees? I might even say it's stupid. But now I turn to our text for today, in which Jesus tells us that God's command to love our neighbor is second only to the command to love God. In response to what was evidently a frequently asked theological question, which commandment in the law is the greatest, Jesus quoted two passages from the Old Testament. In verse 37, he cites, but paraphrases a little, Deuteronomy 6:5, the command to love God with every part of your being. Verse 39, then, is a quotation from Leviticus 19:8. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And verse 34 of Leviticus 19 is much like it, but extends the command to love beyond neighbors, beyond one's own people, to include aliens, foreigners. As we consider the theological virtue of love this month, we could probably spend the whole time talking about what it means for us to love neighbors and foreigners, especially in regard to all our present concern about race. But as many have observed, just the first part, which Jesus explicitly repeated, is difficult enough. G.K. Chesterton famously said 110 years ago, almost to the day, "The Bible tells us to love our neighbors and also to love our enemies, probably because they are generally the same people." So I could spend more time on my feelings toward our annoying neighbor, tree-killing neighbor, and what it might mean to love him, but I'd like to take the text in a different direction for now and talk about the assumption that is at the heart of the second greatest commandment. Loving your neighbor as yourself implies and assumes that you love yourself. Since loving, or at least liking oneself, is the subject of much, much popular psychological wisdom in our time, I suggest we spend some thought on what self-love actually is. I'll come back to my hard-to-love neighbor in a bit. In that popular psychology I mentioned, we find two interesting and seemingly opposite opinions about what might be called self-love. First, there's a positive appraisal of self-love. Jesus' direction to love our neighbors as ourselves is often understood this way. We're told that we simply cannot learn to love others until we first learn to love ourselves. So there's a whole psychological and educational movement and industry aimed at fostering self-love, sometimes going under the designation self-esteem. Concerns about sexism, racial stereotypes, and body image all get caught up in the worry that some of us do not think very well of ourselves. I've had several pastoral conversations with people who describe their experience that way, self-hatred, lack of self-esteem, things like that. Learning to love oneself, then, it's said, is the pathway to a better life, to flourishing as a human being. On the other hand, self-love in the pathological form that psychologists call narcissism has been mentioned fairly recently in conversation and opinion pieces about certain people in positions of power and leadership. The term narcissism derives from the Roman author Ovid's story about Narcissus, a young man of such exceptional appearance that he fell in love with his own reflection as he stared into a pool. According to Ovid, he wasted away there by the pond, unable to leave his beloved. When he died, wood nymphs covered him with their own hair and arranged a funeral, but when they returned for his body, all they found was the white and yellow flower we call a narcissus. In psychology, narcissism is a combination of intense self-focus and desire to be admired with a nearly complete lack of empathy or understanding for others. Narcissistic people can be initially charming in order to cause other people to give them the admiration they crave. But their lack of empathy generally makes long-term relationships almost impossible for the truly narcissistic. That's the extreme, but psychologists tell us that narcissism is a spectrum. Many of us exhibit to some degree. Loving oneself, like so many other facets of psychology, is a mixed bag. We need it to some extent to be healthy, but when it goes too far, the result is less than a fully human life should be. My own understanding of self-love for most of my life has been a deep distrust and suspicion of it, at least in part because I generally find myself oversupplied with a positive self-image. In my honest moments, I recognize that I often have way too high an opinion of myself and what I deserve in life. I feel the discord between that way of seeing myself and Jesus' call to focus on others and even to deny yourself, as he said frequently about what it means to follow him. So pretty nearly exactly 30 years ago, I preached a message on this very text as part of a series entitled Things Jesus Didn't Say, But People Think He Did. And I included that sermon titled Love Yourself, implying that people think Jesus said that, but he didn't. In other words, my message then was that Jesus did not mean at all here to command us to love ourselves, but only to love God and others. I thought the common suggestion that a command to love yourself is implied by the command to love your neighbor as yourself was completely misguided. I said the idea that we have to love ourselves before we can love anyone else, even God, would in fact make self-love the first commandment, which is not what Jesus said here at all. And so I set out to show that God is not interested at all in whether we love ourselves, but only in whether we love him and those around us. But that was not quite right. God does care whether we love ourselves. In fact, that's the way he made us. Self-love is natural. It's human nature. That's exactly what Jesus assumed when he told us to love our neighbors as ourselves. He started from the fact that everyone, unless she has some psychological disorder, loves herself. It's the same point Paul made about the marriage relationship, speaking to men in Ephesians 5, verses 28 and 29, saying, "Husbands should love their wives as they do their own bodies, for no one ever hates his own body, but he nourishes it and tenderly cares for it." Now, don't get bogged down in the fact that some people do seem to hate themselves or hate their own bodies. Jesus and Paul were talking about what is normal for human beings. That the fact that almost everyone loves himself and wants what is best for himself. And that brings us to what I didn't quite get 30 years ago. To understand what self-love is, we need to get clear on what love is. There are lots of definitions. Love is so big that no definition quite captures it. But at least one solid suggestion from Thomas Aquinas is that, at its best, love is wanting what is good for someone. And what is good for human beings, says Thomas, is to be happy, truly happy. Not just happy in the sense of getting what you want in the short run, but being happy in the sense of being fulfilled, content, fully satisfied, and at peace. To want that kind of happiness for someone is to love that person. And, says Thomas, and as Jesus and Paul assume, almost everyone wants that kind of happiness for himself, for herself. The upshot is that when Jesus, or Moses, long before in Leviticus, tells me to love my neighbor as myself, he's not telling me that I first need therapy to deal with lack of self-esteem in order to love another person. He's telling me to turn the same kind of perfectly natural concern, love, which I have for my own happiness and well-being, toward others. If I am hurting because of poor self-esteem, then let my desire to be free of pain extend to others who are in pain. Let me want them to be happy as much as I want myself to be happy. In talking about another aspect of loving others, the act of forgiveness and love towards those who have done something wrong, C.S. Lewis brings up the old Christian saying that one ought to hate the sin, but not the sinner. In asking us to love our neighbor, that seems to be what is asked. To return to my tree-cutting neighbor, I'm to want to hate what he did to that tree, but not hate him. But sometimes that feels like a tall order. Lewis says that for a long time he used to think that it was silly and impossible. How could you hate what a man did, he says, and not hate the man? We might think of all the terrible things the news tells us about what people have done and ask the same sort of question. How am I not to hate him or her given what they've done? Lewis' answer goes back to our business today of self-love. He writes, "But years later, it occurred to me that there was one man to whom I had been doing this all my life, namely, myself. However much I might dislike my own cowardice or conceit or greed, I went on loving myself. There had never been the slightest difficulty about it. In fact, the very reason I hated the things I did was that I loved the man. Just because I loved myself, I was sorry to find that I was the sort of man who did those things. Loving our neighbors, then, according to Lewis, means constantly remembering and applying to others what he realized about his own self-love. Another great saying of Jesus points us in a similar direction. Do to others as you would have them do to you. This great commandment to love others as yourself is basically saying something similar. Do to others as you would do to your own self. So popular psychology is actually right about how important self-love is for being able to love others, even to love God. I was wrong to downplay self-love so much when I preached in this passage 30 years ago. But what pop psychology may overlook is that I cannot pursue self-love all by itself. I cannot focus solely on my own happiness and expect to find it. Without loving others, especially without loving God, I cannot really love myself and find happiness. Both self-love and the desire for happiness, and if Aquinas is right, they are pretty much the same thing, are like those floaters some of us get in our eyes when we're older. They're little imperfections in our retinas which appear as black spots in our field of vision when we look at a light-colored surface. The thing is, those floaters are typically not front and center in our vision. They're off to one side or another. And because they're actually part of our eye, when we try to look directly at them, focus on them, they move as we move our eyes, slipping away from us. And that's exactly what happens with self-love and our own happiness when we try to focus directly on them. As Joseph Pieper explains it, quoting Bernard of Clairvaux, there's a great paradoxical relationship between self-love and love for others, between desire for our own happiness and desire for the happiness of someone else. If we offer love towards someone else in a kind of self-loving calculation for what we will get in return, then both our love for ourselves, our own happiness, and our supposed love for that other person will slip away from us. But, says Bernard, all true love is without calculation, and nevertheless is instantly given its reward. In fact, it can receive its reward only when it is without calculation. Thomas Aquinas explains it this way. When you truly love another person as yourself, then your conception of your own happiness expands to include the happiness of that other person. What makes that person happy makes you happy. What grieves or hurts that person grieves or hurts you. Thomas follows Aristotle in the idea that a beloved friend is like another self. Love for a friend makes us perceive his or her happiness as if it were our own happiness, says Thomas. To expand what Scripture says a little, we love a neighbor as if that person really were our own self. I'm still wrestling to grasp this idea of self-love, including what is good for someone else. But here's a few thoughts on what Moses and Jesus and Paul taught us. Loving someone like I love myself is what I felt toward my daughters when I took them fishing. I love to fish. I especially love to actually catch a fish. But when two little girls came into my life, that self-love of the joy of catching a fish expanded in such a way that it was an even greater joy to take them fishing and watch one of them catch a fish. All that I love about fishing myself gets reflected back to me in her excitement to feel a tug on the line, her breathless struggle to reel it in, and her wide smile of pride when it's hoisted in the net and we measure it. The glorious paradox is that I've made myself the happiest at just the point I've totally forgotten about my own happiness and focused everything on hers. That paradox of self-love and love for others is played out over and over in our lives. It's maybe easiest to see in family relationships. They're good, and happiness feels like our own. My wife has a peaceful, happy day drawing in her book, and my own soul feels refreshed. If she receives bad news or has lots of pain in her knee, it's as if my own heart or body aches. My own self-love, what I think is good for me, has come to include what is good for her. That's what really loving someone like you love your own self really means. That's why the narcissist is so damaged, so hurtful to himself and to others. That lack of empathy means he cannot feel someone else's good as if it were his own. And because of that, he never gets the paradoxical reward of finding that he's actually doing good for himself, loving himself, by caring about what is good for others. The narcissistic paradox is that the narcissist cannot even truly love himself. All that Jesus is asking us here is to learn to love not just family or close friends in that deep, my other self sort of way. In the video on racism some of us watched and talked about this past week, Phil Vischer ended a concise, dense recitation of the injustices done to black people in America with the simple suggestion, care. I think Jesus is telling us here to do that. When I see or hear of another person unjustly arrested or even killed, Jesus says, try to feel as if it were my own self being put in handcuffs or lying there in the street under someone's knee. Let that person in my heart and in my mind, at least for a few moments of caring, be another self, another me, regardless of the color of his or her skin. Maybe most of Christian life is learning how to practice this paradoxical self-love toward others. It's a little easier to see how the greatest commandment, to love God, brings a reward with it, because God saves us. God does so much for us. But that second great command, to love others as ourselves, is a long, slow process of discovering that I haven't even really begun to love myself until that love for myself expands to include care and love for others around me. And that kind of expanded self-love doesn't come by calculating what's good for me and what I'll receive when I show love to others. It only arrives as I forget myself and my own happiness and treat the happiness and good of someone else as if it were my own. Jesus did not leave us without resources for learning and growing in this paradoxical self-giving self-love. He told us to love each other as we love ourselves, but he also told us to love each other as I, Jesus, have loved you. Jesus himself is the great example of what I'm talking about. Jesus, along with his Father and the Holy Spirit, expanded the love they share so much that they treated our eternal good and happiness as if it were their own. Jesus came, forgetting about what was good for him, to suffer and die so that we could be set free from sin and made alive. He showed us exactly what it means to love others as we love our own selves, because that's what he did for us. This week, I encourage you to think about Jesus' example and all the times when someone else being happy has made you happy, when your love for yourself expanded to include loving another person. Then try stretching that a little further. Try to imagine the happiness and well-being or the distress and worry of that rude driver behind you, that annoying neighbor next door, or even that narcissistic coworker, as if their own joy or pain were your own. Remembering Jesus, forget about the effect they have on you and consider your effect on them. And then see if anything changes, if anything grows in you, if perhaps you even feel a little better about yourself by making their happiness, their pain, your own. Me, I'll think a little bit more about my neighbor in his tree. Amen.